This webcast was brought to you by the Library Science Program at the University of Missouri.
Well, hello again. This is Show Me Libraries, and this is Charlie Seavey, your host for the program. We're on the line with Chuck Haddix of the Marr Sound Archives at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. A great collection of music of across the ages, as near as I can tell out. Chuck, nice to talk to you.
Good to be here with you, Charlie.
Super. Tell us a little bit about the Sound Archives, where it came from and how big it is and all that kind of good stuff, and then we'll see what kind of questions we can get into.
Well, the Sound Archives was established in 1987 with a foundation gift from Gaylord Marr, who was a professor of communication studies. And he was a pioneer in using audio materials in the classroom. For example, when he would talk about the immediacy of radio, he would take in an audio clip of the announcer covering the crash of the Hindenburg,
mm-hmm.
to show the power of the media. And also, he was a pioneer in looking at music in a cultural context. For example, media during World War II, he'd go in and play World War II songs. And music is a reflection of the society that produces it. And so we look at music in a cultural, social context, political context too. And, since then, the collection has grown to include 295,000 titles. The focus of the collection is the American experience as reflected in recorded sound. That's what sets us apart from a lot of the other institutions, other recorded sound collections across the country. Most of them are opera and classical, and we do have an outstanding opera collection and a fine classical collection, but we also have a very extensive jazz collection. We have popular music, country and western, old-time hillbilly, old-time radio programs, rock and roll, soul, blues, items that reflect the American experience. And we provide public service from 9 to 4 o'clock Monday through Friday. We're located on the ground floor of the Miller-Nichols Library for good reason. These are very heavy items. And we have 78s, LPs, 45s. The collection is organized by label and issue number. That gives it a permanent place on the shelf, and it also draws together duplication. The LPs in the collection, some 95,000 items, have been cataloged, and they're available in the online catalog of Merlin, the online catalog of the University of Missouri. So the collection is available. The collection is used by a wide variety of individuals. Our main user group, of course, is the students and the faculty of the University of Missouri, Kansas City, but we also provide reference services for scholars throughout the world, from around the world. Most recently, we've supplied all of the audio World War One songs and speeches for the World War One Museum that just opened here at the Liberty Memorial. So,
yeah, in fact, I was going to come back to the World War One Museum after a while, but you've already opened that up. So how much external work like the World War One Museum do you do, that sort of consulting? I don't know what the good term would be, but.
Well, we do quite a bit of that. As it comes our way. For example, the city was developing this going to Kansas City, 12th and Vine Plaza, and they needed a informational kiosk for the display for the park, and so we developed that for them. And I researched the 12th and Vine area, an area which I'm already familiar with, and then wrote all the text and worked with the designer on it. So we do a lot of that sort of thing. We provide a lot of reference services for movies and other production companies.
Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly enough, 12th Street and Vine, I could only find two recordings of that tune in your collection using Merlin, which is not tremendously user-friendly for sound recordings, I think.
Well, you know, it's Merlin is well, actually, if you go in and do what you have to do, you have to have the right search strategy. You have to kind of, to search popular music, you have to have a little different search strategy. If you go in and do the advanced search, and then you put in Kansas City, and then you select the title, and then you limit it by material type to sound record, and then hit, and then maybe what you can do also, you can also limit it by putting in Stoller.
Yeah, Lieber and Stoller, which is actually the way I got to it. I found Spike Jones and somebody I'd never heard of.
Yeah, hold on just a second. I get 12 hits, but there's probably more than that, simply because the song's been recorded a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
it, actually, yeah. You probably, it's because of the cataloging rules, a lot of it's going to be going to Kansas City, and there's going to be variants in the title.
Yeah, this, well, I hadn't thought of that. I knew it went back away. I mean, the big hit was, what, 62,
okay.
63, somewhere
along
there.
Yeah, if you go in and you go into the exact title field, you'll come up with 151 hits on Kansas City.
Okay.
There's two different listings for Kansas City for some reason. And sometimes if you go into the content notes at the bottom, and it'll reveal both variants.
Yeah.
I mean, this, you know, it's just a case of where uniform titles sometimes aren't uniform.
One of these things, you know, you obviously know what you're doing, and I sort of know what I'm doing, and I wonder how much the average user knows what they're doing. Well, that's neither here nor there, but I thought it struck me as a great place to have a sound archive, mainly because of that song.
Oh yeah, well, you know, Kansas City's always been a music center, and Kansas City has long been a destination in song.
Yeah.
Beginning with Carrie's Gone to Kansas City by Blind Boone. And, of course, through today, they still write songs about Kansas City. Literally hundreds of songs have been written about Kansas City.
Well, Route 66 went through, as I recall it, too.
Oh, yeah. And this, of course, is one of the cradles of jazz. So it's quite, by naturally, we would have this kind of a collection here.
It wasn't one of Robert Altman's lesser-known films, in fact, about Kansas City?
Yes, it was. And it was, I think he was a little too close to that one. He's being from Kansas City. We did reference work for that film, and I had the pleasure of watching them shoot some of it.
Wow.
It was, what they wanted to know is what the sound of Kansas City would have been like in 1933. The only problem with that is there were no recordings made between 32 and 35 of Kansas City artists. And, what their premise was that bebop had already been discovered in Kansas City at these late night jam sessions that came out of that. And it was a correct observation. So we did reference work on that. We also worked on Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, which was really a kick because, Dick Robbins, who was the music director, was a really sweetheart of a guy. And, you know, he wanted, like, he needed the music, sheet music for Blue Moon. So we had the sheet music upstairs. He wanted to assemble a group that would play modern music, like Mrs. Bridges' psychiatrist would listen to. And a lot of times they just want fact checked is what they want.
Yeah.
I had the pleasure of attending the cast wrap up party. And
oh,
it was very, very interesting standing in the kitchen and seeing Paul Newman come up the stairs.
Yes.
Pop a beer and grouse because there was no peanuts, and Mr. Merchant was cooking Indian food for like 150 people at the buffet, and they flew in El Shankar. So sometimes when you work in libraries, it gets to be quite glamorous.
Yeah, I've never had anything quite that exciting happen to me, I got to admit. But, yeah, that must have been a hoot.
Well, it really was. It really was. There's been a lot of things that we've worked on over the years that have been really fun projects.
I was kind of under the impression that bebop didn't show up until after World War II. Obviously, I was mistaken there.
Well, Charlie Parker, when he was, last year I co-authored this history of Kansas City jazz called Kansas City Jazz from Ragtime to Bebop, a history. I co-authored it with Frank Driggs. It was published by Oxford. And what I found out was that Charlie Parker had really in the late 30s began moving in that direction here locally.
Yeah.
And a lot of the older musicians, according to Claude Fiddler Williams, used to call it crazy music, but he was playing bebop in Kansas City in the 30s, but it really didn't come to fruition until he, it would become fully realized until he hooked up with Dizzy Gillespie in the early 1940s.
Yeah, yeah. This is just me, but I've always kind of thought bebop was a mistake on the part of jazz musicians, but that's just me.
I have pretty big ears. I kind of like it all myself. I like outside jazz. I like hillbilly. You know, I have broad musical taste, shall we say.
Well, I think if you're serious about listening to, I mean, there's very little. I don't listen to much rap, I got to admit. Do you collect any of that? I mean, that's a very urban kind of a music, it seems to me.
Well, we fortunately, our collection development policy falls outside of our collection development policy. We do not collect CDs. We collect nothing but historic formats, LPs, earlier.
Interesting. Okay.
And we do have a few rap recordings like Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and the Sugar Hill Gang, Rapper's Delight. And early things like that. We do have a collection of funk. We just received a record collection from a friend that had a lot of Parliament Funkadelic records in it. And our student assistants just went crazy over this collection because it had all this punk rock stuff in it, early punk rock and funk. And they really like to work that collection.
So you're really limited to the pre-digital recording. You're doing everything up to CDs, which I suppose is up through. How about tapes?
I do not collect cassettes or 8-tracks because the LPs are available, and I don't want to go there with those formats. I just made that conscious effort. We do have a non-commercial recordings, like, for example, tapes like. We have the Raymond Scott collection. He was the man who made Cartoon Swing. He led a very popular group called the Raymond Scott Quintet, and he had an orchestra, and he was a music director for many years for the Hit Parade.
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite an interesting character, and he also was an engineer. And so he collected, we have tapes in his collection, but they're non-commercial. They're original material.
Mm-hmm.
So we have oral histories and that sort of thing, but. As far as commercially issued tapes, I don't collect the open reels, the 8-tracks, or the cassettes.
It seems to me there's I was looking at on the web page the list LPs, 45 cylinders, various kinds of older record. I mean, there's a huge technological infrastructure you've got to maintain there. I've got a turntable at home that I haven't fired up for 5 or 6 years, probably. How do you maintain things that'll play 78s or 45s or the old wax cylinders?
Well, actually, most of the historic equipment, we just use it for display, or I use it when I get an acoustics class that comes in or a radio production class that wants to know about the evolution, the history of the media.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm able to point to a radio that was from 1924 and say, okay, this radio, you know, cost $200. It was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
This was the band you would have listened to, and I point to the Coonsanders Nighthawk Orchestra banner that hung in the Plantation Grill in Hotel Muehlbach in 23. And, you know, then I talk about vertical cut, lateral cut, talk about, you know, how even today, how, you know, with the introduction of the iPod, how the technology changes the way we use music.
Mm-hmm.
With the introduction of the iPod, the object has fallen aside. You know, it's now a digital file. It's not a compact disc. It's not an LP. It's just a digital file now. And it exists inside the iPod. And, you know, and talk about, you know, how people use the media. Say, for example, when we were kids, we used to get together in the basement and have a sock hop or the garage and play 45s and dance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it would be a communal experience. And today people walk around plugged in, you know, to a little iPod, and it's a very personal way people use media today is very personal. As far as reproducing the historic formats, we have a preservation studio, and I have an engineer that works. We actually have two preservation studios, and I have an engineer that works, that operates it. And we use a CubeTech Quadriga digital editing system. We have a special turntable that can play any record from 5 inches to 20 inches.
Wow.
And we have a variety of styli because there's no standardization of groove width in the early recordings. And
mm-hmm.
when you get into instantaneous cut discs, depends upon how hot the cutting head is, how sharp it is. So we have to experiment with that. We also have two Otari open reel machines that we use to reproduce tapes on open reel tapes. And we can convert them to DVD, to CD, store them on a hard drive, on the server. We store our projects to what's called LTO tape. And it's a digital tape that's standardized. And we save all of our projects to that. When you're talking about preservation in the digital age, you have to have redundancy in case one of the formats fails.
Oh, yeah, yeah, or goes away, or...
Yeah, and you're looking at mass migration to to preserve it in the future. And so we do a lot of projects for other institutions. Right now, we just finished up a project for Washington University Special Collections of authors reading their own works. And now we're also working on a project for the Chicago Jazz Archive, preserving open reel tapes in the John Steiner collection, things like interviews with Thomas A. Dorsey, very interesting material, interviews with Buddy Guy and Junior Wells and Mike Bloomfield, live performances. A lot of times, tapes that were produced between 1974 and 1994, develop what they call sticky shed syndrome. And what happened is when they banned Wailing in the early 1970s, they changed the formula of open reel tapes, magnetic tapes. And the formula proved to be unstable. And the backing sheds, when you run it through a machine, it'll gum up your machine. And so we worked a lot with sticky shed syndrome tapes. Recently, what we do is we take and use a food dehydrator to dry them out. It's called hydrolysis. And it dries them out, and you get one pass at them.
Yeah, wow.
And recently, we've been working with New Letters on the Air, which is a literary program that's published. This is broadcast over public radio stations, and it's produced here on campus. And over the years, they have like 25 years of open reel tapes that they've recorded of, you know, major authors reading their works, Pulitzer Prize-winning authors discussing their works. And a lot of these tapes are beginning to break down, so we've been doing some restoration work for them. And recently there was a black poet named Milton Mbembe Smith, and he passed away 24 years ago, and his 60th birthday was approaching. They had one tape of Milton. And we restored that, and they were able to use that in a celebration. And I heard it the other morning on KCUR-FM, our public radio station, as part of a news piece promoting an event that was happening the 18th of Vine. So, you know, what we do makes a difference in the community.
Yeah, yeah. This is, so you're actually, it's both preservation and making multiple format backups, if I followed all that.
Yeah, basically our mission is to preserve and to provide access to our holdings. You know, that's what we do. And,
yeah.
And a lot of institutions will have, you know, maybe 100 tapes. They don't want to set up a preservation studio, so they contact us and we'll transfer it to preserve it for them.
So to get back to the LPs for just a minute, let's say that I want to listen to, this is a set that I used to own many years ago, the Benny Goodman's 1938 Carnegie Hall concert.
Sure.
Which, as I recall, it was 6 or 8 78s. You're going to let me listen to the 78s, or is there a tape down there?
Well, we've got it on LP. I'd probably pull the LP, but if you wanted to listen to it on 78, that's not a problem. We get you set up in the back studio, and I'd have one of the students or one of my staff go ahead and play it for you.
Well, this is interesting. I mean, how, you know, this physical contact, every time you use the thing, there's wear involved. How do you balance off the, you know, the fact that it's a self-destructive process in a way?
Well, it's not as destructive if you play it on the right equipment.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, our turntables, the tone arm on the turntable in here, I think we paid $2,000 for the tone arm alone. We use an SB15, Technics SB15 turntable. It's variable speed. Those are, they no longer make those. But we use very specific equipment for, to reproduce these historic items. And as far as the LPs are concerned, I let the patrons play the LPs under our supervision. The first thing, of course, I ask them, because we have a lot of students, you know, young students using the collection that have never used a turntable before.
Yeah, oh boy, that's
so
scary.
We give them a little tutoring and, you know, and talk to them about putting their fingers on the groove and all that stuff. And,
yeah.
If need be, we'll play it for them, you know. But, you know, I want the collection to be used. And that's why I collect duplicates. I usually keep two copies of everything.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I hadn't thought about, I mean, if you get a really high-end turntable, and I don't think I ever spend more than $100 on a turntable. I was thinking about the Benny Goodman recording, which disappeared somewhere along the line, but I had the original LP of Louis Armstrong plays W.C. Handy.
Oh yeah, we've got that. That's great.
And the CD doesn't have the same cuts on it, which annoys the heck out of me, even though it's got a good dirty joke on it that the record didn't have.
Yeah.
But I literally destroyed that thing listening to it. I mean, it just, I wore it through somehow or other.
Well, you know, the problem with the digital technology, and particularly CDs, is that it cuts off the higher frequencies, just cuts them off. Because, you know, your ear can't hear those frequencies anyway. And the problem is that notes come together above those frequency to create harmonics that gives the recording the warmth. If you go back and listen to some of those early CDs, they sound terrible.
Yeah.
Because they were limited. The technology was limited. They're better today. MP3 files, you know, everybody wants to listen to MP3s, but sonically they're inferior to the LP.
Yeah, this is a long-standing argument about the analog or digital recording, and obviously you're coming down in favor of analogs. Friend of mine and I that I talk about jazz with every now and then makes the same argument. Now, I lost some of my high-range hearing years and years and years ago, so I'm not sure I can really hear the difference anymore. But people that care about it really get adamant about the superiority of analog recordings, and I wonder if we're losing something there.
Well, you know, not only we're losing that. I mean, there's a great revival in vinyl now. A lot of young kids are coming here like the vinyl. Hold on a second. Not only are we losing that, but think about how the record industry's changed. A friend of mine who's a librarian for Notre Dame, a music librarian, decided that he was going to do a joint digitization project with another institution. They were going to digitize their 25,000 their LPs and make them available so that they could preserve those LPs. But being a good librarian, he thought, well, I'll check and see how many of these I can replace on CD. And there was something like only 1,000 of those items still in print.
Mm.
While the consumer demands more and more greater variety of songs, you know, the iPod, for example, now holds 20,000 tunes. Radio stations are shrinking their playlist, and the record labels are not reissuing key recordings in their catalog. You know, for fans of classical, that's really a problem. You know, CBS Sony jettisoned their classical department years ago, and BMG, which is RCA Victor, a few years back, basically let go all their major classical artists. I think Yo-Yo Ma, still there's a market for him, but for a lot of these there was no market, and so a lot of that material is not going to be reissued. And, you know, of course, you want to buy Mata Hoople, it's sometimes difficult to find, you know. All you can get is a greatest hits package. You know,
yeah,
I'm not saying that, but
yeah,
that's just an example. A lot of times all you can get is a greatest hits package on some of these artists.
Yeah. On the other hand, somebody just released 3 discs or something like that of Fats Waller, which I'm going to have to go out and spend money on. But
I've got that anthology. I do a radio program, too, called The Fish Fry on FM 89.3 KCUR. It's available at kcur.org.
Little plug there, folks.
Sure, why not? And it's Blues Soul Rhythm and Blues Jump and Jive in Zydeco. It's a public radio party I've been doing for 20 years, Friday and Saturday night from 8 to midnight. So I get a lot of recordings through the mail. And I received that one. I feature Fats Waller. It's really a nice set too. And they did a good job on remastering that too.
Yeah. I've loved Fats Waller for years. My dad was a big Fats Waller fan. So, you know, again, there are probably some 78s that have disappeared over the years that I wish I could get back. But, it's interesting to see where we're going with this. I mean, you know, if there's a return in the market for vinyl recordings because of the sound quality involved, I got to admit I adore my iPod. It goes into the car with me on trips and makes things infinitely easier. Maybe we'll see a resurgence of analog recording here, although the hardware is always an issue.
Yeah, that is. You can still buy turntables, but, that's why collections like this are so important.
Right.
We're the repository for our collective memory of recorded sounds. You know, I'm collecting Aunt Ebby because in 10 years you're not going to see the LP collections, the 78 collections like you see now.
Right. I used to live in Arizona and there was a huge used vinyl store. I mean, this thing was enormous. And the last time I was back in Tucson, a couple, 3 years ago, they've gone out of business. They've disappeared. And I don't know what happened to that collection. I mean, they must have had 100,000 albums in there, easy. And I think it's kind of too bad. I actually bought some stuff out of there that I still have.
Yeah, the market decides what formats will survive, and also which music will survive.
Yeah.
It will be made available. VHS and Beta were introduced at the same time. VHS survived, even though Beta was a better system,
mm-hmm.
because they had the movies.
Mm-hmm.
they had the good movies,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
It's the same way with these, recently Nintendo issued the Wii, and PlayStation put out PlayStation 3. And, you know, these are two competing systems. The Wii's more versatile, and all the young kids pick up on the Wii. And so that's probably going to be this year's model, shall we say.
Yeah, and who's going to keep the archive of those? I mean, there's just all these preservation issues we've got and digitizing everything in sight. And I keep thinking, you know, what do we – this is a little out of the sound archive business, but what do we not know about archiving paper? Very little. What do we not know about archiving digital formats? Almost everything.
If I want to keep a piece of email, you know, I get a lot of email. I print it out.
I
don't know where it's at.
Doesn't surprise me in the slightest. There are libraries that will download and print out stuff just because they don't trust the website to stay there all that long.
Yeah, and also you're faced with software obsolescence. I have a whole drawer full of WordStar files.
Yeah.
All the DisplayRight Assistant. What strikes me though is how greatly things have changed. Not only in the sound archive, but also in the library. When I first started working here, we had one computer, and it sat on the director's desk, and he played Pong on it. and now we have our information commons and. You know, we have to adapt to the new technology.
Oh, yeah.
That's what we do. For example, for interlibrary loans, it's a real sticky. With interlibrary loan, of course, with a non-circulating collection, you just don't do it usually. But what we do is if we get a request for something, we'll digitize it, put it up on our server, and send the institution the RAM so the patron can listen to it remotely.
Yeah, it just amazes me. I mean, I've gotten some really obscure stuff on interlibrary loan recently, and I'm being waved at that we're running out of time here.
Hey,
so
we could go on for a couple of.
Oh, months. We could.
Why don't
we
you
could
come on up, man, and hang out at the sound archive with me.
Yeah, right? I'm going to have to come down for a visit. This sounds too good to pass up.
Oh, you'll get a kick out of this place.
Yeah, I probably will. Well, Chuck, I want to thank you for being with us. I wish we could have allowed an hour for this. We could keep rolling for a long time.
I tell you what, let's do part two sometime.
Hey, not a bad plan.
I didn't even get to talk about the digital library projects we've been doing. So
we'll get back to it. Yeah.
And also, remember, you can visit us at umkc.edu/lib. And while you're there, check out our online online projects, our online digital projects. We are known for that. We recently digitized a World War I recordings, a number of those, and the sheet music, and matched them up. And it turned out to be a really very interesting project. And those are the online exhibits at umkc.edu/lib.
Fantastic. Chuck Haddock's a guy who is even better than I am at slipping plugs into things.
All right. Listen, Charlie, you take care now.
You too. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Is your library making a difference in the lives of people it's dedicated to serving? If it is, then someone in that organization might win a graduate scholarship from the University of Missouri-Columbia. The Make a Difference Library Challenge is sponsored by the MU Graduate School and the MU School of Information Science and Learning Technologies. We challenge your library to make a difference in the quality of your constituents' lives through innovative programs that employ information-rich and technology-intensive strategies to meet their needs. For more information about the Make a Difference program, check out our website, makeadifference.missouri.edu. That's make-a-difference.missouri.edu. This webcast was brought to you by the Library Science Program at the University of Missouri.